Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Commerce Committee to order. We've got a very, very long and tight schedule, so we're going to get started with a couple of bills that we're going to take some public hearing testimony on. We'll be working in and out of what the agenda is based on needs that I have for making sure I have a committee still here. So what we're going to do is we'll start off with, I believe it's going to be Senate Bill 355. And at this point, Senator Nelson, why don't you give us a... before you do that, I don't want to start off the day on the bad side of my counsel. Counsel, why don't you please tell us about Senate Bill 355?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 355 allows tax-exempt charitable organizations to conduct bingo, lotto, or Monte Carlo event operations in more than one county. It has a dash one amendment. The amendment authorizes the licensee to conduct bingo, lotto, or Monte Carlo events at a permanent site.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Nelson. I'm state senator from District 29, which includes the four counties, Union County, Willamette County, Umatilla County, Morrow County, and Northeast Oregon. I'm here with one of my constituents, Margaret Davison, who operates some of the nonprofit organizations in LeGrand, and she's driven 300 miles, and I appreciate the chair's indulgence of putting us first, and I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Okay.
I also told Margaret to speak from the heart, and she doesn't have to read her testimony because you have it in front of you, and we'll carry along with this. But this bill basically is to correct an error to allow them to go into more than within one county. We just received today a letter from Ross Laburn from the Oregon Department of Justice. You probably have it saying that in paragraph 3, they had three issues with that. And we thought we had an amendment, a proposed amendment also, that we were going to propose to you today. But since it's not a work session, we won't bring that forward. We thought we had the issues taken care of. But I think we need to go back to Ross and talk to him and say, okay, can we resolve this problem in some way? So with that, I'd like Margaret just to introduce herself and speak from the heart. And
great. Thank you for having us here today. My name is Margaret Davidson. I'm the Executive Director of Community Connection of Northeast Oregon. We serve Baker Grant Union and Wallowa counties with senior programs, affordable housing, transportation, et cetera. This bill really goes to the heart of us being able to provide local support for our senior programs, and the money we make off of our bingo operations goes right back into expanding our senior meals and Meals on Wheels programs in Baker and Union counties. We ran into a glitch last year when the DOJ discovered that by accident we had been issued two bingo licenses years and years ago, more than 10 years ago, one for our Baker County operations and one for our Union County operations. And the DOJ gave us a year to come up with an alternative, and Senator Nelson was nice enough to sponsor this legislation for us. And we've talked with Ross Laburn at the DOJ a number of times and thought we had worked out a solution. Now it seems like there's some issues that we'll try to hammer out again. But basically, we've got two bingo operations, two separate counties programs, and it's important that we're able to continue to operate our bingo programs to support the senior programs in both LeGrand and Baker City area.
Thank you. Anything else?
We'll just work on this and try and tell I'll be in contact with Anna and see what we can work out.
Okay. And Senator Nelson, just for your information, we did receive an email from that, that's going to be part of the record from the DOJ. So that's going to be part of our record. I understand that we will continue to work. We just want to make sure you got your testimony in. There's no one else that's scheduled to testify in Senate Bill 355, but I want to ask and give you an opportunity. If you want to give testimony on that bill, now's the time. Thank you very much. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 355. And at this point, we'll go ahead and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 935.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 935 requires auto insurers to make a settlement offer for a vehicle that is declared a total loss based on an average retail of substantially similar vehicles determined by an independent valuation service. There is no amendment. There's no revenue impact or fiscal impact on this bill. I believe we might have a letter. I'm not sure.
I didn't see one.
Okay. Not on that one.
So, Senator Ringo, I know you're going to give us an opening on this. I have three other people that are scheduled for a testimony on this as proponents, and I have four that are opponents. So why don't we go ahead and get your overview, then I'll bring up that first panel.
Mr. Chair, if I could just ask Robin Kilpatrick to come up with me.
Okay.
Really, I'd just like to introduce her and very briefly introduce the issue, but then let her give the main testimony.
That's fine. Thank you, Senator.
If she can come forward, that'd be great. And here's some written testimony as well. Thank you. Senator Przanski, members of the committee, thanks for hearing this bill. This bill relates to an issue that seems minor and unimportant until you've been involved in an auto accident and you're trying to get your vehicle fixed. And then you realize how insurance companies handle the valuation of vehicles. And just in my law practice, I've seen this over and over and over again where the practice really seems unfair to the consumer, and all they're trying to do is to get their car fixed and replaced. Now, a typical example is that somebody buys their vehicle, and let's just say they pay $15,000 for it, they drive it off the lot, and then a month or two later, they're in an accident where their vehicle is totaled, and the insurance company says, well, here, we'll pay you $11,000. And the person says, but wait, 2 months ago I bought the vehicle for $15,000. Surely it didn't decrease in value by that much. And it just happens over and over and over again where they're just not given a fair valuation price for that vehicle. And they have very little recourse under the law. Whether sometimes they'll see a lawyer, and the lawyer says, well, gee, how do I do this in a way where I'm going to make money, and I'm sorry, I can't really help you. And that's the problem that this bill is intending to address. And the way it addresses it is it allows the Department of Consumer and Business Services to specify by rule which way they'll come up with a valuation for the vehicle, which system they'll use. Right now, the auto insurers seem to use two main ones, the ADP system and the CCC system. Those are both companies that do valuations, but they have a lot of errors, and because they're captive to the insurance industry, they have a vested interest in giving valuations that are incorrect and too low and unfair to the consumer. I think it was just last week, my staff received this letter from the woman to my right, and I think the best thing for me to do is just let her tell her story. Her name's Robin Kilpatrick. She's from Sandy. She sent this letter to my office, and I'd just like to ask Sandy to tell her story on this issue. Go ahead.
I'm not sure how many details you'd like to know, but my husband...
Robin, before you get started, if you could just, for the record, tell us your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name's Robin Kilpatrick, and I'm from Clackamas County.
Thank you very much.
Okay. My husband was involved in an auto accident on June 3rd. He was hit by a drunk driver. We have struggled with the insurance company. Our car has been sitting since then at the repair shop because we believe it's worth about $8,000. $8,500, and the Kelley Blue Book and an independent auto appraisal has been done on it that came up with the same thing. The insurance company's first offer to us was $5,400 for our car. We actually went out shopping and we checked some of the specific autos they were comparing to ours. One of the most important ones was that we actually went to Gresham Honda because they supposedly had one of these cars that CCC used for their comparison. When I spoke with the gentleman there, the car had been wholesaled off the lot for more than they had quoted on the CCC value scope. So I spoke back and forth with Safeco several times until we finally got to the point where we paid for an independent appraisal, and since then they have ignored everything that we've said. They sent the checks for how much they thought the car was worth and have just not done anything since then. I'm not sure what else to tell you, so maybe you could ask me questions.
Well, we'll see if there's any questions. We're not going to ask you questions if we don't need to.
Okay. Mr. Chair, The thing I'd like her to explain just a little bit more is there were several comparisons that she checked, and just could you just describe the various comparisons that CCC offered and what you found?
Okay. There were three main comparisons in the CCC value scope. I told you about the first one. The second one was... in Bremerton, I believe. And so after we found what we did with Gresham Honda, we called that dealership. And the gentleman, the salesman, told my husband that it was a souped-up kid's car. Our car only had 61,000 miles on it. This one had 112,000 miles on it. And he said, they're hard miles. You don't want this car. That was what they used to compare to our car to. The third one that they used was supposedly a private party car, which means a private party was selling it. The reason that's important is because they deduct $665 for, quote, dealer prep against the car, our car that they're valuing it. And when we called on that one, it was not a dealer car. It was a private party. So all three of their main comparison cars they used were less than substantial, and they all had, all but one of them had more than 100,000 miles on it. We also went to our own insurance company, which was State Farm. They used the ADP AutoSource. It wasn't as easy for me to decipher, and I couldn't pick it apart, but their value was $7,080, which is what they offered us was $7,000. When I gave them the comparables that we had found and a copy of the appraisal, they said, you can go to your appraisal clause of your policy, which costs $250 for your deductible. It already cost me $300 for the independent appraisal, and it'll cost another $400 for the appraiser to go through the arbitration process, and then I have to pay for half of the arbitrator, the middleman who works through it. So there's no value left in doing that because it costs as much as the extra value of our car. When we've spoken to attorneys about this, most of them don't want to mess with the car part of this thing because there's no money in it. It isn't worth it to them to do anything with it. So we're stuck. We have absolutely no idea how to work through this other than to just lay back and take what they've offered us, which isn't enough to replace the car with.
Senator Barr.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions for Senator Ringo. I heard CCC and ADP, are those two appraisal organizations?
No, they're valuation organizations. They're totally different from an appraisal.
Okay.
They take a bunch of cars. They try to keep a database of the cars bought and sold in the area. And that's what they use, is they run a string of those, and that's what they try to use to value your car. An appraisal actually takes your car and values your car, tells them what your car is worth.
My understanding, Senator Beyer, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, is that those two companies I mentioned, CCC and ADP, are valuation services that work wholly for the insurance industry. And that's why they have an interest in giving low valuations, and there really isn't a lot of independence in the valuations that are put forth. That's why this bill allows DCBS to issue rules to say, okay, what services shall do valuations. I, one of the things I should have said and didn't is that I've talked to the Department of Insurance and Joel Arroyo's office for several years about this, and I said, how do we solve this problem where somebody buys a car for X dollars, and very shortly thereafter, it's totaled, and yet they can only get this much? Joel Arroyo, the state insurance administrator, said this is the single biggest source of complaints the insurance can get. More than any other type of insurance complaints, this is number one. I said, well, what are you going to do about it then? I said, if you get this many complaints, there must be something there. What do you suggest so that people can get a fair valuation on their vehicle after the car's been totaled? And after a while, they came up with this, and this is language that they drafted. So it's really their solution to the biggest source of complaints that the insurance division receives.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm trying to figure out what the difference, because it seems like you used the same terminology in the bill that they did, where we got independent valuation service, as what you said the CCC and the ADP are.
I think it's the idea that they can have some role in the selection of those services rather than the insurance company saying, we're going to use the one we select. For example, let's say they use a Kelly Blue Book, or there's other, the NADA books. There's other valuation services. And so it's a valuation service that might be selected by DCBS that they really think is independent. And that's the goal, is to have an independent valuation.
So I think DCBS is going to come up later, but is that how, what would you envision, is that DCBS would make a list of accredited or whatever valuation companies or yeah. And then insurance companies could choose from that list?
Well, I think DCBS is going to have to set up the rules on how to do it, but it's that type of system, yes.
So then if we get in this scenario, if these two companies happen to make the list, and
that's right,
then what?
Well, if that's the number they come up with, then that's it. But I think it provides more guarantee that it's a fair number and it's an honest number. And that's the goal of this.
Okay, I'll ask DCBS how they would go about finding who's fair and who's honest.
Okay, that's a fair question.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And let's see, I'll go ahead and call Neil Jackson. Looks like Carl Lundberg. If the two of you would please come up.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm a member of the Board of Governors. I'm here in favor of Senate Bill 935. There are a couple of things that I could probably help the committee with. Number one, my understanding from the historical background of this is that originally, and the commissioner's office can straighten me out, but my understanding is that originally they went through some kind of a process and they eventually arrived at using CCC and ADP as the recognized services, value establishment services. They then backed off that and basically said, we don't specifically by name recognize any service. However, personal experience, about 2 years ago, I had the same thing happen to a client of mine that happened to Ms. Kilpatrick, who testified. And when I called I was told by the adjuster for the insurance company, we're using CCC because it's recognized by the commissioner's office and we don't have to use anything else. And I went, wait a minute, I got Kelly Blue Book here, I got NADA here. And I called the commissioner's office and was told by one of the staff there, yes, that is correct. We don't recognize Kelly Blue Book. We do not recognize NADA. And I'm going, how can you not do that? Kelly Blue Book is what the banks and the credit unions recognize, and that is what the dealers use. Well, these are the ones we recognize. And it is true that CCC and ADP market their services to the insurance company, and they're their clients, and necessarily I think they're going to have lower values. I talked to somebody from the department last week, a fellow, and he said that what Senator Ringo said, they get more complaints about this than about anything else. We're in favor of this bill because we think if the commissioner's office looks at it and takes a look at all the valuation services, and there's Mitchell's, there's Edmonds, there are a lot of them, they may well decide that all of them are legitimate and say you can use any of these. It may not solve the whole problem, but at least there will be a broader database to use so that the consumers have access to maybe a more realistic market value, hearing what Mrs. Kilpatrick said, to where the consumer has a shot at it and can say, wait a minute, you know, these services are legitimate also, and they're also recognized by the commissioner's office. We're strongly in favor of this bill, and there's no money in it for trial lawyers, none at all. This is a consumer bill, and we'd urge you to support it.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Senator Prosansky, members of the committee, my name is Carl Lundberg. I'm the deputy administrator for insurance for the Department of Business and Consumer Services, and I'm here today to ask your support for Senate Bill 935. Senate Bill 935 establishes standards insurers must use to determine the value of a motor vehicle that's been declared a total loss. A total loss is when an insurer decides it doesn't make economic sense to repair a vehicle damaged in an accident. The insurer looks at the vehicle's pre-accident value and compares that to the cost of the repairs plus the vehicle's salvage value and associated expense. If the repair costs and related expenses exceed the car's pre-accident value, the insurer will declare the vehicle a total loss and make a cash settlement offer to the insured. Total loss claims have been the subject of many complaints in the insurance division over the years. We closed 449 formal consumer complaints about a total loss in the past 2 years. In addition, we logged 1,130 telephone inquiries relating to total loss in the last 18 months since we started tracking these calls. The high number of complaints and inquiries is due in part to America's love affair with automobiles. Many people attach sentimental values to their vehicles and are unhappy when the insurer's settlement offer falls short of their expectations. So there will always be complaints about total losses, but we believe that Senate Bill 935 will help make the valuation process fairer and more objective. Before explaining what Senate Bill 935 would do, let me give you a brief history of the valuation system. Insurers used to get price quotes from auto dealers to establish a car's value, but many consumers questioned these quotes as being subjective and inaccurate. In an effort to improve fairness and accuracy, the insurance division adopted an administrative rule in 1998 allowing insurers to use valuations obtained from computerized data services such as CCC Information Services, Inc. and Automatic Data Processing, Inc., which you heard referenced as ADP. Unfortunately, consumer complaints didn't go down as we hoped they would. Many consumers feel market data compiled by these companies is biased because they're paid by the insurance companies. As regulators, we do our best to ensure that the valuation process is a fair one. But this has proved challenging when the process is tailoring each valuation to individual circumstances and leaves significant flexibility to computerized database services whose client is the insurer. Senate Bill 935 would require an insurer to make a total loss settlement offer based on the average retail value of similar vehicles produced by two or more independent valuation services. The key word is independent. Unlike the computerized database services that currently provide valuation to insurers, these independent valuation services, such as Edmunds, the National Automobile Dealers Association, and Kelley Blue Book, are used by a variety of interests, including car buyers and sellers, auto dealers, insurance companies, and others. Because they serve multiple constituencies, independent valuation services produce valuations that are more generic and less tailored to individual circumstances, though there are some individual considerations such as mileage and condition of the car. Some may see this more generic approach as a disadvantage, but we believe it can be an advantage by ensuring equal treatment and reducing concern that a more subjective process favors insurers over consumers. Such a system should also reduce costs for insurers. We recognize that Senate Bill 935 is not a panacea. There will always be disagreements about total loss valuations. It may be that a hybrid between the current system and the proposed one would be better. We understand some parties will propose more discussion along these lines, and we would be happy to engage in those discussions. In any event, we believe a more independent valuation process will provide for improved valuations and increased consumer confidence in the fairness for the entire process. We're happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yeah.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. So you set up a process in 98 that you thought was better by looking at these, what do you call them, evaluation services. Mm-hmm. It hasn't helped. And now I'm confused because if you make a list of the, and if these ones, I guess, how are you going to determine who gets on this list if it doesn't?
Well, we will make that determination by having an open rulemaking process and take testimony and hear what competing interests have to say about the various valuation services. With regards to the what our practice was in 1998, what we did is we recognized valuation services who applied for, and we gave them a certification that we recognize them. And then what happened was when we tried to represent the interests of the consumer in terms of trying to work out a fair settlement, the insurers would say, well, you've recognized this valuation service, and therefore, you know, it's too bad. And we got caught in our own process. And so what we did is we repealed that rulemaking piece so that rule no longer is on the books. That, however, didn't prevent insurers from using these processes, and so many insurers continue to use these valuation systems, and we continue to have the same kinds of issues coming up when we're trying to look at how the prices were arrived at that you've heard articulated earlier before I got up here.
So, Mr. Chair, you can't give me any idea how you're going to determine who's going to make this list. I mean, so the criteria. You have nothing in your mind right now. That's what you know. I mean, if you're going to do something, you're going to pass a bill, and you end up with the same two companies on the list that you already don't like being on the list, yeah. What happens?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byrd, we haven't... The bill doesn't spell out what criteria that we would have to set out in order to make this decision. But we would set out a criteria as a process that we thought would arrive at a fair process and would produce valuation services that were independent and would be considered by all of those who participate in the process as a fair valuation services. And there would be more than one, which the bill contemplates, so that there would be an average of the valuations that were obtained, which to give a more fair and objective view of the valuation rather than having a single determination made by any source, whether it's independent, totally independent, or whether it's paid by the insurer. And that's the only valuation that can be used that will be used by the insurer. This bill will result in having more than one valuation service and would result in an average of the valuations being the determining value of what the total loss was.
Mr. Chair, I don't know what your intentions are or who's going to come after to speak, but I'd be interested in knowing what sort of criteria you're going to use to decide who's an independent and who isn't. That's, mm-hmm. If you could get back to us on that or yeah. We'll hear from other people coming up later.
We've got four people that are scheduled to testify, actually five, that are in opposition to the bill. This is the last of the proponents. The chair is not planning on moving this bill today. My understanding, though, is what this process is going to be is actually through the rulemaking, which actually will mean that the individuals that are interested in this will be actually, I think, at the table trying to hammer out what the procedure is going to be in the process as compared to us statutorily putting something in. I think we want the flexibility so those who are more certified smart than we here at the table can actually determine what's the best approach for doing that. But I think we can hear from the opponents and see what their thought is.
Yeah, and I appreciate that because I understand the rulemaking process, but we also need to set parameters on what they can talk about in the rulemaking process.
And since we're not planning on moving it today, it seems like we're going to have some opportunity. If we need to put some more sideboards on it within the statutes, we can do that.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to work further with anyone who wants to have any further discussion on this.
Senator?
Thank you. Just a question. Thank you, Mr. Lomberg. I just wanted to understand your interpretation of the bill. But let's say the list includes five or six services, and then poor Ms. Kilpatrick is nailed by another drunk driver and she needs to get her car. Who selects the two? Is it the insurance company that will select the two valuation services that will then be averaged?
The way I read the bill, that's how it would be done.
Okay. So there might be five people on the list. The insurance company selects the two that will be used, and then they use an average.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Any other questions? No, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'd like to go ahead and call up this time Sean Miller. I believe it's Art Sharad and Jack Monroe. Anyone seeing Jack?
Jack.
Oh, here he comes. Mr. Monroe.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sean Miller. I represent the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America, which has approximately 300 member companies that do business in the state of Oregon. I'm also here today on behalf of ADP Claims Services Group, which is just one of the valuation service companies that you've heard from just previously. I know you're going to hear from Art here soon on the other one, CCC, but here today in opposition to Senate Bill 935, Mr. Chairman, and I want to just go through the problems that we see in the bill and why we don't think the bill is needed, because it does give this broad authority to DCBS to decide which valuation company can do business in the state of Oregon. I think contrary to what you just heard, Mr. Chairman, in lines 8 and 9 of the bill, when it talks about a settlement offer based on the average retail value produced by two or more independent valuation services specified by DCBS. It doesn't say specified by the insurance companies. And so I want to, for the record, clear that particular statement. The other portion of the bill, Mr. Chairman, is, and again, I think dealing with the average, in that statement on lines 8 of the bill where it talks about the retail value of substantially similar vehicles and taking that average within those, you know, the two or more specified by DCBS. You know, Senator Ringo did offer up, you know, what is fair and honest when it comes to that valuation. And Mr. Chairman, I would like to say that, you know, ADP, for example, bases their valuation services completely on the local market. It's one of the requirements. There is standards within the insurance code currently, and so within those insurance codes, which in, it's insurance regulation 836-080-0240, these regulations mandate certain standards of comparability for vehicles using valuation, which is same or new year, similar body style, similar mileage and options, and the valuations are statistically valid for the following criteria. And it goes on to say that the source can produce values for 85% of the makes and models for the last 15 years. They rely on values of vehicles that are, were available within the last 90 days. And, Mr. Chair, I think the most important thing is to consider is that it gives primary consideration to vehicles in the local market. And what I mean local is if your total loss was in, for instance, Portland or Eugene, or you're looking at values of similar retail sales of cars or automobiles within that particular market to come up with a valuation. Given the fact that these standards are already in the insurance code, if there's things that we need to look at to actually strengthen those standards or look at some of those standards, you know, I know we're willing to go over and have this conversation with the insurance division. I think it's done by rule. The problem with the bill, Mr. Chair, again, it gives this broad discretion to decide who can do the business in the state of Oregon. And if you're going to create an average of a number of companies, that's not always going to be a benefit to the consumer. If you're taking a local, essentially a local market figure that is designed between companies like ADP, and you'll hear CCC's process soon, you're getting an actual market reflection in that area. Other guidebooks such as the National Auto Dealers Association and Kelley Blue Book are regional in nature. The auto dealers includes Alaska, Idaho, Utah, Washington, and Oregon in its Northwest edition. The Kelley Blue Book includes Alaska, Idaho, Oregon, Montana, Washington, and Wyoming. And so, again, depending on the certain locality that you're going to take this average from and how, in which company and how you're going to average based on Kelley Blue Book and others, it's not specified in the bill, and we're not necessarily know how the insurance division would interpret that. You could be incorporating a lower average of values of automobiles in other states, which I don't think is a benefit to the consumer and to the person that's in the total loss claim. And so I think all these problems are issues within the bill. Again, we are willing to have this conversation over the insurance division. There is standards there. Once these valuation companies meet those standards, they can do business in the state of Oregon. If we need to look at those, we're willing to do it. I don't think this bill is necessary, however. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just, before I conclude my remarks, I want to I've handed out an example of an auto ADP auto source valuation. It's on a 1996 Chrysler Sebring. And this is just, again, an example of how they would conduct a valuation. On page two of the bill, you talk about the typical vehicle on the left-hand side and the lost vehicle and then the adjustment. And you can see it goes through everything from comparable of miles to all different features, including things that they've added onto the car where they actually add adjusted amounts to. And so you can see it's very detailed. Going on to page 5 of the bill, where it talks about the replacement vehicles, this is the data that was in the database of the comparable vehicle, and this has recently been offered for sale in that particular marketplace or locality. On page 6, you can see all those comparable values and see exactly all the data and all the features that are being considered within that database. Again, on page 6, we're talking about page 6, 7, and 8 goes through 8 Chrysler Sebring models. Again, comparing that to the model that is being compared with the total loss. And those are from dealer inventory vehicles. On page 8 of the document, it goes through private party vehicles and compares page 8, 9, 10, and 11. Goes up to 20 vehicles that have recently been sold. Again, you can see by detail how this database tries to correspond the lost vehicle with the replacement vehicles that are being sold, again, in that local area as compared to some of the guidebooks. That's a regional area. I think the average, we have a problem with the average approach because we don't necessarily think that will benefit the consumer based on real local numbers. And second of all, I think this broad authority by DCBS to decide who can do business in the state of Oregon is a concern. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will conclude my remarks and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Gentlemen, who would like to go next?
You go ahead. I guess I'm next. My name is Art Chartrand. Excuse me. I'm from Kansas City. I represent CCC Information Services of Chicago. Great to be in your state once again.
Thank you.
CCC is one of the world's largest property valuation companies. They are an independent property valuation company. They produce fair automobile local market property valuations. You know, it's a great thing about this country of ours that you can sit in front of a hearing like this, and I know you're after the truth, but people can come up here and say anything without having to substantiate it. And it's probably a good thing because we want an open process here. But we've heard allegations that we are wholly controlled or are wholly owned by the insurance industry. Absolutely not true. We also serve the auto body industry. We also serve the rental car industry. We also serve a lot of other industries out there. And so people can make allegations about who we are and what we are. They simply, the facts don't always back them up. They can say that we are out there trying to orchestrate lower values. You can say that, but the proof and the evidence when it's come in court or it's come to fact-finding hearings simply doesn't substantiate that. That's not what we're about. At all. I have hard-earned credentials, I believe, as well as a consumer advocate, serious credentials. I was a attorney for the National Association of Insurance Commissioners for 8 years. I helped draft the regulations, which Oregon has right now on the books. I think they work. I co-host a weekly and often guest host a weekly radio program called the It's Your Money radio program. We're on weekly, 12 to 2 Eastern Time on the National Radio Network. If you ever listen to us, we get a lot of consumer call-ins, deal with a lot of consumers on a lot of issues. And I started life as a small-town trial attorney. So I'm representing CCC. I think like you all have experience as a consumer. Certainly I have experience as a consumer, too. One thing we agree on. We certainly agree on what Joel Arroyo, the commissioner, has said, what Carl Lindbergh testified to, and I think all you have said. Consumers love their cars. Americans have a love affair with their cars. Unfortunately, Senate Bill 935 would turn the data-driven automobile valuation fairness doctrine back almost 25 years. SB 935 on the surface sounds kind of lofty and good, but when you get it into practice, you're going to find that this doesn't work. The Oregon Insurance Department tried this approach several years ago. They found it didn't work. They found that by trying to micromanage the property the property valuation industry, it just doesn't work. West Virginia tried an approach like this a few years ago. They tried to mandate the use of NADA. What they found was that ended up, after they did the study, after they adopted the law, they decided then to research it and do a study, and found out that that would lower the valuations to 40% of West Virginia consumers. Once they realized that, and the consumers realized that, well, it sounded good on the surface, but that's what it would do, they repealed it. Oregon now, on the books with the insurance department, has a proven regulation.
Can you get the mic away from your
computer? Oh, I'm sorry. Is it feeding back? Yeah. A little too loud?
Yeah, it's very sensitive.
I apologize. We have a proven regulation on the books right now. My suggestion is we should let it work. Dumping data-driven and market-driven, consumer-driven, individual valuations for averages, and that's what we're after here in this bill, is wrong for consumers. Averages, by definition, mean that half of the people are going to probably be paid more than their car is worth, and the other half perhaps less than their car is worth. I don't think Oregon consumers are average. I don't think they want average, really. They want individual, fact-based, objective valuations on their car. I suggest to you that despite what some people have said, Senate Bill 935 is very anti-consumer. We agree with Commissioner Arroyo. There were complaints before his regulation. There are complaints after his regulation. He never suggested complaints went up. He just said we still had them. And you always will when it comes to total loss values on automobiles. He cited in his written testimony that the insurance department handled 449. These numbers are very important. 449 complaints in basically the last 2 years on total loss auto valuations. CCC alone, and we only maybe do half of them, to 35,000 total loss valuations just in the state of Oregon in that same period. 449 complaints, barely one a day over a two-year period, based on perhaps as many as 70,000 total losses. I think anybody would be proud, particularly in this type of industry, of that sort of complaint record. It's minuscule compared to the number of valuations we do, where most consumers are very satisfied with their evaluation. I mentioned the other day when I was testifying this, we all remember a few years ago that commercial with Clara Peller, the gal, the Wendy's lady, used to always come out and say, you know, where's the beef? Our argument with this particular bill is, where's the beef in it? Where's the studies? Where have we done the research? Where is the evidence that suggests that the valuations are going to end up in somebody's mind higher, better, lower? We don't know. It's an assumption that, well, we go to this, things will be different. I don't think that's the right way to approach something like this. Average values, the subjective opinions, by the way, of automobile dealers. NADA, by the way, someone is assuming here that they are independent. NADA stands for National Automobile Dealers Association. This is the automobile's for-profit organization of the people that sell cars. They are anything but independent in this process. I'm a consumer. You're a consumer. Fortunately, Senate Bill 935, though, is going to leave half the people out in the cold because it only applies to insureds. It doesn't apply to third-party claimants. So the insureds are going to get average values, and hopefully third parties are still going to get individual valuations on their total loss claims.
Ryan, I'm going to ask you to go ahead and kind of wrap up if you could. I think you've made your point pretty clear.
Let me go to alternative solutions because I think that's what you want to hear. I think we're all searching for answers. So, hey,
Mr. Chartrand.
What are we offering in return? Let me suggest.
I'm listening.
The current Department of Insurance regulations need to be out there. They need to be, so consumers know, there's a right of recourse. Someone came up here and testified that she had no recourse. There's a written consumer right of recourse in the current Department of Insurance regulations. Doesn't require you to go to court. Doesn't require you to hire a lawyer. All you have to do is raise your hand and say, that valuation is wrong, and it puts the burden back on the insurance company to either pay the difference or produce a car. That's a self-effectuating mechanism. It works. Why don't we limit valuations in the state of Oregon to Oregon data? Now, that sounds to me like something that's pro-consumer. The books have multi-state regional data from states all over the place to give you average. If we really want to help consumers out in this state, let's limit the sources to providing Oregon data on real Oregon cars and individual consumer-based valuations on their car.
Thank you very much. Mr. Monroe.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I guess there are only so many issues embedded in a one-paragraph bill. And
we're hearing them all.
So I'll try and avoid going over ground that's already been covered. But let me just say that
Mr. Monroe, could you just give us your name for the record?
Oh, you bet. I'm sorry. I'm Jack Monroe, speaking today on behalf of the American Insurance Association. I think our concern with the measures is based in some of the questioning that Senator Beyer has offered up, and that is we don't quite understand what this bill is intended to mean. We don't know what an independent valuation service is. We don't know, based on the bill, what standards DCBS is going to use for the process of determining what valuation service needs to be used. What we do know, of course, as has already been mentioned, we have an existing rule that's been on the books since late 1998. That rule has some considerable specificity about what an acceptable database is, and Sean gave you, I think, the high points of it. Has to be based on local information. Has to cover a wide range of makes and models, et cetera, et cetera. Respective, I guess, of whether we have the division approving it or not, and I think as was mentioned earlier, they initially sought to approve them and then got out of the business of approving them. They clearly have the authority and have had the authority to enforce this rule. And if, for example, in their judgment, evaluation service was being used that wasn't consistent with these rules, to take enforcement action. And one of the questions you need to ask is, why haven't they done anything? The second point I would make, about the existing rules is, as Mr. Chartrand pointed out, there is a mechanism in there for dealing with disagreement. And so, when I look at the existing rules and then look at the bill, I'm only left wondering, well, if this doesn't cover the ground, what is it that will cover the ground? What is it that we are talking about that will vary from the existing rule, which lays out again in great detail what an acceptable database is and has a mechanism for remedying complaints? So, it's really, I think it's really the sort of vague nature of the bill and the obvious questions that are raised by the language that that leaves us concerned about what might be contemplated here and therefore leaves us opposed to the bill. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Senator.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Were you from Kansas City?
Yes, sir.
Well, welcome to Oregon.
Thank you. Good to
Good. Again, right?
Again.
I'll tell you, I've learned a lot about payday loans since I've been here.
Okay.
Hang around.
If you need any more testimony
in the future, then.
Yeah, we've got a lot of interesting issues. Hang around. You know, the problem I have is, and Sean, you have this, the ADP, the list. I've had people bring this into my office, and they've checked these, and they've been full of errors. They say, okay, one of the data points is 1996. They call and go, you know what? It was really in 1991. And they go down one after the other, and they're wrong. And most people don't go to that trouble. Most people just suck it up and take the bad valuation and just write it off, I'm getting screwed. But the people that are angry, like the woman in the back, and check, the numbers are wrong. And I'm very interested in what the answers need to be. Let me ask you this. If they checked and there was wrong data, is it okay for you guys to pay a penalty? How about a penalty for every wrong information in the comparable? You up for that?
I think we'd be up for that. One of the things we're concerned...
You're up for that.
We'd be up for that. One of the concerns we have, Senator, is the fact that the books say on the books, and it's in our written testimony in black and white, they won't even guarantee the accuracy of their data. It says it right in the book. We guarantee the accuracy of our data. And if a consumer finds an error, let us know, because we'll correct it. But when the real facts come up, we find that that's really usually not the case.
Yeah, but the point isn't correcting it to make it right. The point is to make sure that consumer was treated fairly. Do you have a figure on how much you make per valuation?
Sure. It's no secret. The average price that we charge for an insurer for evaluation is around $35.
I see. And is there, I just sense a competition issue that you're looking at not having other valuation companies going head-to-head with you. Is that an issue here?
No, we believe in we'd like to have all valuation companies available for Oregon consumers and let everybody see them for what they are. We're not saying these other sources don't have some value, but you need to understand what they are, who promotes them, and why they're out there.
I think follow up, just a couple more, Mr. Chair.
You're on a roll, but nobody can stop anyway.
I'll stop soon. You know, Senator Beyer raised a good point about what the information should include in the bill to give guidelines on the rulemaking. And Mr. Monroe expressed concern. Well, we don't know. I mean, if we put some guidelines in terms of defining independent, does that make it comfortable with the bill?
Yeah, I think the devil's in the detail.
Well,
Senator Brzezinski, Senator Ringo, I think, you know, once again, the devil's in the detail. I guess we'll need to take a look at what you mean. I mean, to my knowledge, none of the services that have been mentioned today are owned, controlled, or in any way involved with the insurance industry.
There's a pretty close financial connection.
Let me interject here if I could. It sounds to me that we actually have some movement toward maybe some type of work group, and I would assume Senator Ringo would be more than happy to maybe meet and see what the middle ground might be, because we're not going to get it today. We know that. And so would y'all in some capacity be willing to at least sit down once, maybe twice?
If it's in the spring or summer, Senator, we'd love to.
The rain in the winter here anymore anyway. And yes, and the insurance division needs to be part of this as well. But I really appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Sean Miller again. The insurance industry is used to these work groups.
Everyone gets their exercise, at least going up and down the stairs.
Another word.
If there's not any other questions, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Powell and Mr. Herbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Powell, and I represent two companies that sell a lot of automobile insurance in Oregon. One is State Farm Insurance Companies, the other is Liberty Northwest. Mr. Chairman, I had to choose today as to whether to testify on a bill next door on colorectal exam mandate for health insurance or this bill.
I think that's the right decision.
Well, I have to tell you, I think I'd rather have a colorectal exam than be part of another work group. I'm sorry.
We won't hold you to that, but
you know,
we understand.
The exam only takes about 40 minutes, and they put you to sleep. It's not bad at all. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, very briefly, I have an expert here because Ernie Hebert is a trains for State Farm in this area, and I think would be a very valuable resource for the committee. So I'm going to make my remarks very, very brief. But we think the way the bill is printed simply trades one problem for the other. We testified against the department's rules when they adopted the rules requiring insurers to use the computerized services. It's not that computerized services are bad. Most insurers were already using them as guidelines. But the goal of reaching the value of an automobile is to do just that, is to reach of that particular automobile. These guide services that are recommended in the bill do not go far enough in recognizing aftermarket parts that are on vehicles, particularly pickup trucks and things like that, that have all kinds of value differences based on what's on them. In addition to that, the average total loss State Farm last year was the vehicle was 11 years old. So that tells you how difficult it is in reaching values. The newer the car, the easier it is. The older the car, the more difficult it is. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Hebert.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ernie Hebert. I'm a claim training team manager for State Farm Insurance out of Tualatin, Oregon. My purpose here today, as John mentioned, is to briefly review our current process that we use under Oregon Administrative Rule 836-80240 in evaluating total loss vehicles. To begin with, we inspect the customer's vehicle, we complete and send a vehicle inspection report to a market research vendor, as you've heard earlier here. The vendor compiles data from numerous dealer and private party sources starting in the local market area to determine value, vehicle values based on the year, make, model, and body style, and then making adjustments for equipment, mileage, and condition. The vendor compares that data with the information that we supplied on our vehicle inspection report and then completes a valuation on the customer's vehicle and sends it to us. And this is where maybe we're departing from some other companies, I'm not sure. We review the valuation with the customer and confirm the equipment, condition, and mileage, taking into account receipts for recently purchased equipment, could be aftermarket equipment, recent repairs, restoration work, or other items. We then make any adjustments to the valuation as warranted and review the settlement amount with the customer. If new information comes to light with regard to information used in determining the value, then we reconsider the value. The vast majority of our total loss claims are settled using this process. For the few instances where the customer is reluctant to settle, the following recourse is available under the current rule and our current policy language. One, if an insured settles with us and cannot find a replacement vehicle for the settlement amount within 35 days, the rule allows for the claim to be reopened and reevaluated. Under our policy, if an insured does not wish to settle with us, we will offer to pay the undisputed amount in exchange for the title or release of interest and will explain the appraisal provision of our policy, which can be used to resolve the disputed amount if the customer elects to do that, or we could use the process to resolve the entire ECV. This helps avoid delays and unnecessary costs in resolving the dispute. We believe that the existing rule effectively deals with vehicle valuations as by being fast, economical to administer, and fair from an insurer and customer point of view. Again, if you're taking the time to confirm the information that's within the valuation and taking other information that the customer gives you into account. With that, I'm going to go ahead and let John follow up. I want to thank you, and if you have any questions now, we'd like to wait till John's finished.
We'll wait till Mr. Powell's finished. Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, because we've been here before and I've had Mr. Hebert here before and we weren't able to testify, I don't want to lose his expertise, so I think it'd be best if we just open it up for questions, if you have questions for Mr. Hebert.
Any questions for Mr. Hebert?
Mr. Chair, my only question is, will you join us in the work group?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, yes, I'd be happy to.
Thank you very much.
I haven't had that pleasure, so.
Well, Mr. Chair,
I'm always looking for a developmental opportunity.
You should bring the six packs.
Yes, okay.
You're welcome. New guy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone else that wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 935? Not hearing any. I'm going to go ahead and close the work, the public hearing. Excuse me, on 935. And I want to make I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on 311 and work session on 311 for the purpose of letting people know that are here. I apologize. I shouldn't announce this at the very beginning. There is an issue with the amendments that came in, and because of that, the bill will not be moved or discussed today. So Senate Bill 311 is off for today. I expect that it's going to be back on the schedule next week, but it will, in fact, be placed on notice at least 48 hours before. My guess at this point is it's probably going to be next Thursday. It's possibly it could be the next Tuesday, but more than likely it will be this coming a week from today. So with that, I'll go ahead and close the work session on 311. And at this time, let's see, I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 738. Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chair, I move to dash six amendments to Senate Bill 738.
All right. We have a motion before us, and I'm going to ask Ms. Brown to
go over those amendments.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 6 amendments were sent out to the committee members. It replaces the original bill in its entirety. It requires the state fire marshal to determine whether cigarettes are fire safe. It prohibits sale or distribution if a cigarette is not fire safe, imposes civil penalties, allows for damages, authorizes the use of New York's list, delays some effective date, establishes the cigarette fire safety fund from civil penalties, and continuously appropriates fund to the state fire marshal. And it contains an emergency clause. This bill is, I'm recommending that it be subsequently referred to Ways and Means.
All right. It's my understanding that based on the potential on the expenditures, that it does require a motion after we look at the Dash 6 to move it if we choose to move it, and it will be to Ways and Means. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. And questions or discussion, I should say, on the Dash 6s for Senate Bill 738.
We've got a Dash 7.
Should be a Dash 6, too.
It's
to the on that SMS that came out last night.
Mr. Chair. And I know that you and I talked earlier, but there is an issue that I don't recall. Maybe I missed part of the hearing on it, but the revenue impact, not the fiscal, but the revenue impact on this measure in this form, I think it is substantial. I think it's consuming millions of dollars of revenue impact of this measure. And with that, I know the fate, but I would move a substitute motion to insert the Dash 7 amendments rather than the Dash 6 amendments for Senate Bill 738.
All right. I'm just looking before we act on that. I just was looking to look at my notes as to the first set of testimony regarding the revenue, because I know that we had one individual, if not two, on that day. Council, do you have that information?
I don't have it right in front of me, but I do recall each time we did hear this bill, we talked about the revenue impacts and the possibility that we would lose state tax money for
right.
the cigarette.
Okay, so we'll just put that on the record. My understanding, if anyone wanted to look back at the record, that I know we had at least one, if not two people, that did testify as the potential impact. But at this point, we have a motion to substitute the Dash 7s for the Dash 6. Council, can you give us a overview of what the Dash 7 is?
The Dash 7 we received today, and my understanding of the Dash 7 that it delays the effective date for 2 years.
Madam Council. the Dash 7, I think, would probably be. You're right. It does. It asks Congress to implement a federal act on.
Right. My review of this, Senator Beyer, is you're correct. It does look like it's saying that it would be the whereas for this being an issue causing problems within the state, and also a need to have some type of national standard. That it would be to have it go through that process, but I think council is also correct when you look on page 1, lines 15 and 16. It basically would put this bill on hold if we passed it with the Dash 7s. It would not be operative until July 31st, 2007, and that's when Section 2 of the current bill would become operative. Regarding discussion on the Dash 7s, Senator Beyer, did you want to give anything, place anything else on the record as to?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think you are correct. It does replace that. I just think that I just agree that this is a national issue and we better address it at a national level. And we had one tobacco company go on record saying they support that at the national level, and the other saying they're neutral on it. Of the two that I recall testifying. And I just think that's the appropriate place for it, so that's why I made the motion.
I understand. The chair would like to just comment. I also agree. I think this is something that would be wonderful if the national government, in the sense that Congress actually took this up and actually enacted a standard across. They have not. This has been before them before. What we know at this point is very clear.
is that we have a situation that there is actually a product that is safer based on the testing and the testimony I saw, that you can, in fact, limit the number of fires, both structural and, I believe, also wildfires. This state is faced with a situation this year of being one of the driest on recorded history, and I feel that we need to move forward with the Dash 6, so I will not be able to move to support the Dash 7s. Senator Whistler?
On the Chair Brzezinski, on the wildfire issue, I'm not at all certain that I agree with you on that, in that certainly a cigarette that is tossed away that doesn't go out is more likely to start a fire than one that does go out. However, if you have to keep relighting your cigarette and you're throwing the matches away and you're out in the forest, you're much more likely to start a fire, and you go back to some of the old Smokey Bear advertisements. You know, you pinch the match out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's kind of like, I think I would analogize one of these safe cigarettes in that goes out, and sort of like smoking a pipe, you just keep lighting it. That would be my concern about the advantage of preventing wildfires.
Okay. I'll just say in response, based on the testimony I've heard, it appears that it is not the same as a pipe or cigar, because there's only one or two, maybe three bands on the cigarette as compared to being multiple bands beyond that. And it's when it hits that tighter rolled piece of paper is where the cigarette goes out. So it doesn't actually automatically go out. It seems to still have the continuity of being able to stay lit until it reaches those bands. But again, is there any other discussion on the Dash 7s?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your concerns for the wildfire issue. Obviously, that's something I'm very concerned with. But the testimony of the Department of Forestry was that some of the wildfires that are man-caused, I think it was 400 and something like that, are caused by cigarettes. But he said by discarded cigarettes, and that people don't normally discard a cigarette that is in the process of being smoked. They discard a cigarette that they are done smoking. So at best, there is probably a little bit left that's going to burn. There is no difference in that little bit that left that's going to burn between one that's going to burn a third of the cigarette if discarded fully. Once you get by those bands, the cigarette continues to burn until it is extinguished. So I don't believe this bill will have any effect on wildfires, because if the discarded cigarette is discarded after the bands are smoked through, it's still going to burn until you get to the filter or whatever's left. And that is the issue with wildfires, not the burning like it is in a potentially in a chair or in a mattress when somebody drops a fully lit cigarette. We don't see that the problem in wildfire. People don't discard fully lit cigarettes, and they don't sit there and smolder for hours. They discard little bitty butts.
Yeah, I didn't hear the testimony as to when it's discarded. What I do know, as a prosecutor, we do have on the books where people throwing ignited material out of a window, that they are subject to a pretty hefty fine.
$1.
And so, at this point, I guess I didn't hear that in the testimony. Maybe it's true, but as I said, I personally will not be able to support the Dash 7s. Is there any other questions or discussion on 7s? If not, I'm going to go ahead and ask Karen to go ahead and call the roll on the Dash 7s.
Yes.
Senator
Rico? No.
Senator
Burdick? No.
Vice Chair
Byron? Aye. No, the Dash 7s do not pass because they do not have a sufficient number. We're back to the original motion of the Dash 6. Are there any other discussion regarding the Dash 6? Not seeing any. Karen, if you can call the roll on the Dash 6.
No.
Senator
Rigo? Aye.
Senator
Burdick? Aye.
Vice Chair Byron?
No reason to make a bad bill. Better go.
Aye. We have passed the Dash 6. And Senator Burdick, do you have another motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that we refer Senate Bill 738 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves the 738 as amended to the Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I will support the motion. Again, I think it's not a state issue at this point in time.
Okay.
I feel the same way.
All right. Thank you very much. Any other questions? If not, Karen, would you please go ahead and call a roll on the motion?
No.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye. Senate Bill 738 passes to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Thank you. I'm now going to start a work session on Senate Bill 912. And I'm sorry. So open a work session on 912. Council, do you want to talk about the dash sixes?
Yes, the committee members should have received the dash sixes today. The dash sixes are technical cleanup language. Basically, I'd like to put something in the record here. The amendment effectively directs the State Board of Pharmacy to classify over-the-counter pseudoephedrine, except in liquid or gel cap dosage forms, as not less than a Schedule 5 controlled substance. This would mean that the product could be obtained only from a pharmacist by the person of age 18 with identification. The pharmacy must maintain a paper log of all transactions. The Board of Pharmacy would not have the option of requiring or allowing electronic records in place of a paper log, and the purchase of pseudoephedrine and hard pill forms would not require a prescription, but the Board would have authority, as it does now, to make it prescription only. The rest of the amendments are basically adding language of ephedrine and phenylpropylamine. I can't say it very clearly. And physicians and veterinarians and other licensed health officials in the bill it went more streamlined with the dash six. So the dash sixes take all the amendments from the dash twos, dash threes, and dash fours and put them in the dash sixes. We don't have dash ones, and we're not moving dash fives.
All right. So it's my understanding, I know that there's been testimony from the Veterinarian Association as to their concerns. Those have been addressed by adopting those or placing them in the dash six, even though they were a separate standing set of amendments prior to the, us coming up with the dash six. Is that correct?
Correct.
All right. Any questions? Yes, Senator Chair,
Martin. Is there anybody here from the Board of Pharmacy?
Well, it looks like we got a volunteer in the back. I was going to say Mr. Holt was here earlier.
And then he
what was the question?
Well, the question, I guess, would be on the dash sixes. I think it's also in the original. I'm not sure if it's in the original bill or not, but it's in the dash sixes. The section sub 3 of section 6, that we already have a temporary rule in place dealing with this issue, and the Board of Pharmacy is set to go forward on April 4th, I think, with a permanent rule. And this language basically codifies what their rule is going to be, is my understanding. And if that's the case, if they already have the rule, why do we need the language in statute?
Okay. I can tell you, let me just tell you my perspective on this. After hearing as much as we've heard on pseudoephedrine and the issues and relying back on the testimony that came in at Pendleton, the chair has taken the position that we need to do everything we can to stop the production of meth in this state. And one of the ways I believe that we can do that is limiting the access to the pseudoephedrine that is in the hard capsules only. This bill, with the dash six amendments, would still allow for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for the other components or formulas of pseudoephedrine to be sold over the counter without any type of login or stuff. So that would be the gel or the liquid forms. And I feel it's important enough and imperative enough for us as the state of Oregon to actually make a statement and make a statute that we are going to prohibit the hard sell of tablets without going through the pharmacy process.
Mr. Chair, I don't disagree with the thing you just said. I'm just curious to know why we need it. I mean, if it's already in rule, why we need it in statute? That was my question.
Yeah.
My other question would be on the dash fives, and you and I have talked about the dash fives, I think, the way I understand it, prohibit the sale of any pseudoephedrine that's not in a liquid form. Is that correct?
That's what
the dash five. Yeah. The dash five is an outright ban. The chair asked for that to be drafted. I've thought about it. I feel very more comfortable with the dash sixes based on my discussion with some of the members from the Board of Pharmacy. The reason I have asked for the Dash 6 is to come forward is because I think that this is imperative enough that I want to make certain by state statute that it's not going to be changed unless we as the legislature decide to revisit the issue regarding how the access of pseudoephedrine hard tablets should be available and not have it subject to a rule that couldn't potentially be modified without legislative oversight.
I can appreciate that. I was hoping we would have somewhat of a discussion about the Dash 5s from the pharmacy people because, like you, I was shocked at the simpleness and the ease and the thought of if this is what they're making meth out of. Mm-hmm. And because we all heard in Pendleton when we were all there, that the pseudoephedrines, they don't cure any disease. They simply treat a symptom. And the gel form is just as effective, the liquid-forming gel forms are just as effective as the hard form, and the gel forms and liquid forms can't be used, at least today, they don't know the procedure to use to make meth from the gel form, then what's the problem with the fines? And no one has come and told me what the problem with fines is yet.
Okay. Well, we can ask the gentleman in the back if he'd like to come forward and identify himself. I thought that that there's a means of safeguard with a prescription requirement that individuals who wanted to still have that through a doctor, that they, we would have this ability to regulate without having the database needing to be developed and secure. I mean, if we got enough support here to do the Dash 5s and outright ban it, I want to tell you, I think the political fallout or pushback will be much greater than at least having the ability for people through a prescription through a doctor to be able to take it and have that filled.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess do the DAC 6s require a prescription for the heart?
They allow the Board of Forestry to acquire a prescription.
Pharmacy. They allow the board to require a prescription on the hard pharmaceutical.
That's correct.
It makes it a Schedule 5 controlled substance.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, that raises the question, if it's defined as this kind of substance, does the board have any mandate to require a prescription? I guess that would be a question I would have of our witness.
All right. If you could please first identify yourself.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, my name is Gary Schnabel. I'm Executive Director for the Oregon Board of Pharmacy.
Mr. Schnabel, thank you for being here.
And Tom Holt represents the State Pharmacy Association, so we're different organizations.
Why don't we do this? Mr. Holt, I didn't see you that he was in the back. Why don't you come on up and join us for this discussion? Please continue. I apologize.
To Senator Burdick, Mr. Chair, Schedule 5 controlled substance does require a prescription. So if this was made a Schedule 5 controlled substance, the board doesn't just have the option. It would require a prescription.
But if I could just follow up, my understanding, I spoke with Robert Rett, who is one of the proponents of this legislation, and he directed me to the rules, administrative rules, that said that pseudoephedrine actually is a Schedule 2, but there has been an exemption in the state for years that allowed for those that product to be sold over-the-counter retail, and that we, under the emergency rule, has pulled back part of that. So it seems like it's been a drug that the Board of Pharmacy has already recognized as being in need of having greater safeguards. And so if you want to maybe elaborate on that.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The board recently adopted emergency rules that put some restrictions on the sale. It didn't change anything about what's in the rule currently about the scheduling of pseudoephedrine. It is listed as a Schedule 2 controlled substance, as you said, with an exception or an exemption for the FDA-approved over-the-counter product, the Sudafed that we're all talking about.
Okay.
What the Board of Pharmacy did was pick out that FDA-approved pseudoephedrine product and then put some restrictions on the sale, which you've all talked about, that it goes in the single-entity products are in the pharmacy only. The gel caps and liquid preparations can stay out into the grocery stores.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. There is a provision in Oregon law, it's ORS 475.045, which I've been reading over and over again in recent days, that prohibits the board from scheduling or listing as controlled substance any over-the-counter form of a medication if it's been approved by the FDA for the over-the-counter formation, so the formulation. So that's the reason why that exemption is there in the rule. The practical effect of the Dash 6, as has been noted by staff, is it would make it a Schedule 5 controlled substance in the absence of any other action. And what that would mean is that a person could obtain the medication only from a pharmacist. The pharmacy would have to keep a paper record. The Board of Pharmacy would not have the ability to allow the pharmacy to keep an electronic form of record in place of a paper record. And only persons over age 18 with proper identification could buy the product. That's what it does. That is basically the Schedule 5 rule from the Drug Enforcement Administration federally. And essentially, a lot's been what Oklahoma did, and a lot's been talked about the Oklahoma model. What they did was codify at a state level the federal Schedule 5 rule. Now, from our perspective, as Senator Beyer pointed out, the gel caps and liquids are, as far as we know, equally effective to the hard forms of the product. So as long as access is maintained to some form of pseudoephedrine, we don't really have a position one way or another about whether, you know, what choice you make in terms of the degree to which you restrict the product. It's our view that given the trends that are going on in all the states, it's probably not very likely that the problematic forms of the product are long for the marketplace at any rate. So we just want to make sure that you all are clear on what the effect of the amendment is and what Schedule 5 does. Schedule 5 does not require a prescription. The Board of Pharmacy currently has and will continue to have the ability to make pseudoephedrine a prescription-only product. I think there's a whole other set of issues with requiring patients to go to a doctor's office to get a prescription for something like this.
I thought I heard that the Dash 6 amendments do not require a prescription for the pseudoephedrine products in hard form. They just require them to be dispensed by a pharmacist.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that would be correct.
But to clarify Senator Beyer's question, I believe that they would have the authority if they chose to use it to make it required by prescription. Is that correct?
Senator Przanski, Senator Burdick, Gary, I think, could answer that as well, but it's be our understanding that that's the case now and will continue to be the case.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to, because I think I gave you bad information with my first answer, too. Schedule 5 does not automatically require a prescription. I think I said it did. I'm sorry. That was wrong. It's Schedule 5 doesn't automatically require a prescription.
All right. So
other controlled substances do. The threes, twos, threes, and fours do.
Okay. Senator Whitsett.
How will this amendment address the veterinarian's use of these products? Will they require a prescription by the veterinarian? Will it require a record by the veterinarian, or does this completely exempt veterinarians from that issue?
May I speak to that, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
The Dash 6 amendments, I don't have them right in front of me, I'm sorry, but they have the part where if the veterinarians are covered by another law that they have to keep a record for, they are exempt from the record-keeping part of this law. So if there's something else they're keeping a record for, then this law doesn't apply.
Okay.
All right. So, I mean, the chair is willing to look at, I mean, actually entertain if we really wanted to go to the Dash 5s. I just think that that's something that I'm not sure if we are ready to go to that degree. I'm concerned. I think one thing that the veterinarians, I mean, it's not that they couldn't get the supply, but it may impact their ability at a cost if it's outright banned. But, you know, if Senator Beyer, if you want to move the Dash 5s, outright ban the hard capsules from the state of Oregon, you know,
from there. But no, I think the Dash 6 is a step that's in the right direction. It's one that I think that will, in fact, I think the Board of Pharmacy understands, based on our testimony, our discussion here, that we are expecting and hoping and anticipating that they will, in fact, look at the prescription requirement. And I would think that the governor's office, based with the task force that he put together, that would be something that will be, let's say, encouraged at that level.
And Mr. Chair, I wanted to let Senator Byron know I would enthusiastically support the Dash 5 amendments should you choose to move them. But I also think the Dash 6 is a step in the right direction. But the bigger comment that I picked up was that these hard pills are not long for this market, and it's not hard to imagine why, given how they're used and given how everybody knows they're used. I can see the lawsuits coming down the road, and I remember way back when Tylenol had their wonderful extra strength pain relievers in capsules, and they got poisoned because they were easy to open up. And Johnson & Johnson eventually stopped using those capsules and used another delivery mechanism for those drugs because they could not take the risk with their consumers to put their consumers at risk from the misuse of those pills. These are pills that they're obviously misused. I think the ideal solution is for the industry to stop making them tomorrow. I would be comfortable with a ban, but there's, if there's another delivery system that works, that's what we ought to do if people want these drugs.
Mr. Chair, I don't mind being bold in this area. I would like to actually, I think maybe it's time for that debate. And as soon as we get done with the Dash 6s, I think maybe we'll have a
problem. Nothing's on the table's clean. All we did is ask for a description of what the Dash 6s were, because I just thought that that's where I thought we may want to go. But well,
before we go to the Dash 5, I'm not sure that there is a preparation that you can use in large animals that would be appropriate.
They could do the gel liquid forms.
It would take you a horse dose might take a while, so that could lead to a problem. And I want to be absolutely certain that does this Dash 6 amendment, would that require veterinarians to write a prescription for those products?
No.
Just keep records of those products. As long as they would be totally exempt from that, this bill, provided that they keep records of their sales through some other means.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, if I may interject, since you are discussing the possibility of the Dash 5s.
We're not.
Just to flag a technical issue, that if you did go that route, you would also need the 2s and 3s to correct some technical drafting issues in the bill.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying, after the 6s, we just talk about that. Can I ask the pharmacist a question?
Please.
You already have the rule basically doing this part of section 6, sub 3. Do you need the bill to adopt your permanent rule?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I don't think we need the bill for that authority, but I know that there has been some question of the board's authority from stakeholders, and that is still on the table. That question apparently is still on the table. So I don't think we need it. I think we have the authority, but somebody's still asking.
But okay. By passing this, we'll make certain that you do have that authority.
That's correct.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 6 amendment to Senate Bill 912.
Senator Byers just moved the Dash 6 to Senate Bill 912. Is there any further discussion on the Dash 6? If not, is there anyone an objection to the Dash 6 becoming part of the bill? Not hearing any. We move the Dash 6 into the Senate Bill 912. Senator Beyer.
Mr. Chair, I don't know that there's any other referrals or anything on this bill. So if not, I would move the bill to the floor as amended.
All right, we have a motion on the floor to move the Senate Bill 912 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I want to see if Charlie wants to vote on this one. Is there any objection to the motion?
Mr. Chair, let's make comment.
Please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I appreciate you working on this issue. We have by last count, somewhere near 70 bills in this building on the meth issue this session. And I would urge that the chair of this committee, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, the leadership in both the House and the Senate, and the chair of the appropriate committees in the House and Senate, to get together, come up with a plan and a strategy, figure out where we're going. This is not a partisan issue. Mm-hmm. This is bigger than, this is an Oregon issue, the meth issue in the state of Oregon. And so I would urge that those of you and the leadership on both sides of the aisle with the governor's office get together, decide on one, two, or three bills that we're going to do it in. Let's get it done.
Right. And Mr. Chair, to Senator Beyer, that the first meeting of that type has taken place with the two co-chairs of House and Senate Judiciary with the governor's office. There are a lot of bills. Some of them are still coming. And that is actually our plan, is to narrow it down to a couple of vehicles. And this is a great vehicle to start with in that process.
Great. And I agree. I actually had the opportunity, I guess, as chair for Commerce to actually sit on that meeting. It definitely was my take from everyone that was there that this was the route that we'd be taking. So if there's no other discussion at this time, again, I'll ask, is there any objecting to Senate Bill 912 as amended going to the floor of the Senate with the due pass recommendation? Not seeing any, so ordered. And I myself will be a carrier, and Senator Beyer, would you like to be a co-carrier?
That'd be fine, sir.
All right, so you'll put myself and Senator Beyer as co-carriers of 912.
Okay.
And going into closing the work session on Senate Bill 912, we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 133. Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 133 was heard by the committee on February 10th. It increases the amount of damages recoverable from a person acting as a farm labor contractor for certain violations from $500 to $2,000. It does have a dash one amendment, which makes it so the legislation will apply to all types of farm labor contractors. It does have a dash two amendments. We're not recommending that the dash two amendments be moved today. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Senator Beyer, do you want to make a motion on the dash ones?
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 133.
We have a motion to move the dash ones into Senate Bill 133. Any discussion? Not seeing any objection. That will be so ordered. The dash ones have been moved into Senate Bill 133. Senator Beyer.
Mr. Chair, I'm frantically going through my bill file, and I believe, and I don't know if you could help me, the dash threes were drafted at my request for the dash twos. Is this not the bill?
No, that was Senate Bill 37.
Well, we had another one where we were off. Okay, here, it's right here, the dash twos. Yes, the dash twos were actually drafted at my request, I believe, because the concern was that what the definition of a farm labor contractor is and the relationship between one farmer to another farmer and whether or not that makes a farm labor contractor if his labor supply goes to another farm for a period of time and then because of lack of work or extra work needed. We had the dash two amendments drafted because it would put that definition into statute, because I think at our first hearing, someone from Bowie said it was a rule, not a statute, what the definition of a farm labor contractor is. They were drafted, and then LC notified us that it was already in statute somewhere else.
It is. I actually looked at that because I wasn't sure when we first got into farm labor as to exactly what we're dealing with, but that's
why I don't believe the dash twos are necessary.
Okay. So we've got the dash ones in, and at this time we're, I think we have a motion at this point.
The bill has amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
And is there any discussion on that motion? Senator Wissett.
Just a short discussion. You know, I asked the question of the Bureau of Labor Industries back way back when about where the civil damages would go if Boley recovered them. And the response I got, and I quote, "Yes, it would go to us if we ever used this provision. which we have not, and if the court ever awarded damage to us, which we can't imagine why they would actually do so, but it allows for such a thing. And the question in my mind is, what do we need this bill for?
I know lots, but I don't know everything. So I'm not going to take a stab at that one. What I remember, and counsel, you may want to help, is that there was, I don't know if it, I understand the answer they gave because I remember hearing that answer. I don't know if they've never received or have ever had an action or issue regarding a farm labor contractor or not. And I don't have my notes clear as to the exact reason the Bureau actually brought the bill forward. And I don't know if you want to have someone answer the question, we can bring someone up, but if not, then we'll go ahead and come on up. Christy.
Chair Pozanski and Senator Whitsitt, Senate Bill 133 is really a private right of action remedy that is available to persons that are damaged by actions of unlicensed farm labor contractors. So this is not a provision that the Bureau of Labor and Industries typically uses. It's for damages. So anybody that is damaged as the result of a contractor acting without a license would be entitled to damages under this statute.
Just one clarification. So it's not actually for the Bureau's benefit. It's for...
The way it's written, the Bureau could use this provision, but we don't. If we take an action against farm labor contractors, we typically assess civil penalties under another provision of the law.
Okay. Senator Whitsitt. Mm-hmm.
Well, the clear language here is the Commissioner of Bureau of Labor and Industries or any other person may bring suit in a court. He goes on. Starts out with the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries may bring suit.
Right. And I think that's a fair assessment as to who can bring suit, but it sounds to me that the Bureau has chose to use a different mechanism or means to actually get compliance through the Bureau. But as you also said, it also allows other people who have been damaged to utilize the court, and this would be a damage potential award that would go to those individuals if they prevailed.
And Chair Pozanski, I might add that the Bureau is typically not damaged by the action of a farm labor contractor, which is why we don't use this provision. We aren't damaged, so we don't have any monetary damages to pursue.
Mr. Chair.
I remain confused, Chair Pozanski, then why do they need the right to bring suit?
I think they have the right already. They have more than one way that they could actually seek a remedy. This is one, and the other is through a civil process within the administrative rule proceedings.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I know members are, Annette Talbot, Deputy Labor Commissioner for the record, our members are always reluctant to have penalties go back to the agency assessing them. So when we do an administrative penalty, it actually goes to the Housing Development Account and Community Development Services Fund for housing. So if we were to assess a civil penalty related to this kind of farm labor issue, it wouldn't go to us.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd have to ask, and I appreciate the email. I hadn't seen the response until you brought it up. But the following question would be, has the any other person ever used this provision of law that it allows? It says the bully or any other person may bring suit in circuit court or in any court.
Chair Pozanski and Senator Bauer, I can't tell you how frequently it's been used, but I know that farm labor contractors who have lost a contract to somebody who has acted without a license have used this provision to sue the unlicensed contractor for damages that they have suffered as a result of not getting the contract, lost income, for example. Also, Oregon Legal Services could use this provision to sue an unlicensed contractor for damages that workers may incur as a result of an unlicensed contractor's activities.
Do you have another question? All right. Anything else?
No.
All right. So I believe we actually have the motion at this point.
Oh, yeah.
And why don't we go ahead and, Karen, well, let me just ask, is there anyone in objection here at the table to the motion that's there that would move Senate Bill 133 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation? Okay. So ordered. Senate Bill 133 is on its way. Do we have a carrier?
I think Senator Ringo wants to carry it.
I do too. Senator Ringo. Good choice. All right. Yeah. We closed the work session on Senate Bill 133 and open a work session on Senate Bill 434. Go ahead, Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 434 was before us on February 15th. It provides authority to the Bureau of Labor and Industries for enforcement of investigative subpoenas. If you recall, concerns were raised by the City of Portland regarding parameters for the subpoena authority. Foley has since put in the Dash 1 amendments, which put parameters in the subpoena authority, and the City of Portland is fine with these amendments.
All right. Does everyone remember this bill when we had it originally? It was back first originally in February, and we, I guess that's the only time we've had it. Senator Barr, did you want to make a motion on this one, or did you want someone else to?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the Dash 1 amendments if I can figure out what it all does.
All right. Senator Barr moves the Dash 1 amendments for Senate Bill 434. It's my understanding the City of Portland had some concerns as to the original bill, and that when they raised those concerns, we basically they closed the work or the public hearing to give the City of Portland, along with Boley, an opportunity to discuss it. It appears that the Dash 1s is a fix that the City of Portland is comfortable with, and so that's why it's now back before us. So we have the motion before us. Any other discussion? If not, is there any objection to the Dash 1s being amended into Senate Bill 434? Not seeing any, so ordered. And Senator Barr, did you want to make a motion on?
Mr. Chair, did the committee council by any chance do a hand and gross bill with the Dash 1s in it?
No, I did not, because they're very lengthy. They're over the whole bill.
And that's what I was wondering. It looks like it's basically a gut and stuff. Is that extensive?
If I may, as I read that the amendment, essentially the original bill, Bureau of Labor and Industry wanted the district court to simply say to enforce any subpoena that they issued. And the new language, as I understand it, puts them on the same playing field as everyone else. If the court agrees with the subpoena after they've reviewed it, they will go ahead and they would go ahead and enforce the subpoena.
Yeah, I'm looking for nods from the Bureau, and it sounds like we got the big official nod. So thank you very much for the pinch hit.
Chair, I move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Barr moves Senate Bill 434 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Not. Is anyone an objection to it? Not. And then so ordered. Senate Bill 434 moves to the Senate floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. And Senator Burdick, would you like to take this one?
I'd be delighted, Mr. Chair.
And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 434 and open a work session on Senate Bill 386.
Okay. Senate Bill 386 has Dash 3 amendments that are on your desk. They fully replace the other amendments. I underlined the parts that are new. Hopefully everyone can find their Dash 3 amendments.
They're fresh off the press today.
They're fresh off the press today. If you recall, we heard this bill from the Management Labor Advisory Committee on March 8th. It defines what constitutes gainful employment relating to permanent total disability, and it establishes a new processes for rescinding permanent total disability status and workers' compensation claims. I could go through the dash 2 amendments, which are basically in the dash 3, and the dash 3 had some wording difficulties. The dash 2 had some wording difficulties, and that's just what the dash 3s are correcting that. But the concepts of the dash 2s are what are in the dash 3.
Okay, and it's my understanding that what you did is you went ahead and gave us kind of a line underlining of the changes that went from the dash 2s to the dash 3 to give us the clarification that right. The dash 2s didn't have.
The dash 3s, the only changes from the dash 2s are the first page, which are the underlined portions. And they just clarify what actually is what's in the dash 2 amendments in my staff report, because the what was in the dash 2 amendments originally said the opposite, accidentally.
Okay.
We fix that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Barr.
Has MLAC reviewed the now dash 3 amendments, I guess, in the dash 2 form of the...
Yes, MLAC has.
Yeah, they met this morning, and I don't know if this is one that they took up this morning or not.
This was approved on March 17th.
Oh, the 17th, so it was last week's. Okay.
Approved in with this
and this isn't a substantive change, because if you look at the dash twos, if you had them in front of you, it just had the opposite language, which really meant it. This language on the page one is modifying the gainful employment threshold, and the threshold is the lesser of the federal poverty level for families 3 or 66 and 2/3, and the dash twos actually say the opposite of that. So that's what the dash 3s are trying to fix.
Okay. Senator moves the dash 3 amendments in Senate Bill 386.
Senator Beyer moves the dash 3s in Senate Bill 386. Is there any discussion on that motion? Not seeing any. Is there any objection to that? Not seeing any. The dash 3s are incorporated into Senate Bill 386.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 386 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves Senate Bill 386 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Not seeing any. That will so ordered. Senate Bill 386 as amended goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Does anyone want to take this one? Or
thank you.
All right, Senator Beyer will take this one. On Senate Bill, and we'll close the the work session on Senate Bill 386, and we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 132.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 132 requires farm labor contractors to provide workers' compensation for workers. It requires the applicant for a farm labor contractor license to provide proof of existence of workers' compensation insurance. We had a dash 1 amendment that clarifies that the scope of who's covered in workers' compensation is not expanded with this bill. There's no revenue impact on this bill.
Senator Beyer, do you have any motions you'd like to make regarding the dash ones?
Still getting to it, Mr. Chair. Before I do, and I don't remember asking for, and I don't know if MLAC takes a look at this issue, but I don't think they did, or and they don't think it's.
Yeah, I don't think.
I don't recall them getting in.
MLAC look at this bill?
132.
Yeah. Okay, Mr. Chair, I move the dash 1 amendments.
I got the big thumbs.
Now
that we get the thumb of approval, is there any objection or any discussion, I should say, regarding the dash 1 amendments into Senate Bill 132? Not seeing any. Is there any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer, would you like to make a motion regarding the bill?
I move Senate Bill 132 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves Senate Bill 132 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I know we had this hearing a long time ago, but is there actually an issue that we had some contractors who weren't providing workers' compensation?
This has been.
May I?
Or is it just a
Chair Prasansky?
Please.
the requirement is that the farm labor contractor license applicant demonstrate that they have workers' comp insurance at the time they apply for their license. We had been requiring it of reforestation contractor license applicants, but not farm labor contractor license applicants.
So, but there, I get just a clarification. There wasn't a case where there were workers who got injured and they weren't covered.
No, Senator Beyer, but conceivably that could happen if they didn't have evidence of coverage at the time that they obtained their license.
Mr. Chair, I move bill.
She wants me to say my name for the record. Christine Hammond, Bureau of Labor and Industries, Wage and Hour Division Administrator.
Okay, I think we're at a point where we've actually have moved the bill. We've got the discussion. Any more discussion? If not, is there any objection to the bill moving to the floor with the due pass recommendation as amended? Not seeing any, so ordered. Senate Bill 132 moves to the floor with the due pass recommendation as amended, and I'll carry this one. And closing the work session on Senate Bill 132, I'll now open a work session on Senate Bill 576.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 576 adds licensed registered nurses to the list of health care providers who may sign to verify eligibility for an employee under family leave law. We heard this on March 1st, and we have a dash one amendment that clarifies that the professional is required to be working with their scope within their scope of license to be able to verify the eligibility.
And the dash one does that as to the limitation.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I remember this bill, and there's going to be a work group on it as a dash four or something.
Yeah, I think what we want to do is make sure there's a clarification that they actually were only working within the scope of their license,
mm-hmm.
and we weren't sure, or we didn't know if the way the original bill was worded, if it actually place that parameter on it, and I think that's what the dash ones were attempting to do. And
yes.
And when looking at the dash ones, that appears to be what occurs.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I guess that's a concern. The concern I remember being expressed at the time was that does this in fact authorize someone to do something that their license doesn't authorize them
right.
to do? And so
that should be a good fix to, let's say, make sure the scope is narrowed to the person's professional license or certificate.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment in the Senate Bill 576.
Senator Beyer moves the dash ones in the Senate Bill 576. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the Senate Bill 576 to the floor to do that with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves Senate Bill 576 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Wissett, would you be kind to carry this one? And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 576, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 119.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 119 authorizes the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to provide reemployment assistance from the Worker Benefit Fund to eligible injured employees and their employers. Requires notice of assistance to workers. We heard this on February 3rd. It has an amendment, dash one amendment, which provides for the reimbursement from the Worker Benefit Fund if denial of vocational rehabilitation benefits is upheld. This has a fiscal statement, and it was on your desk today.
Mm-hmm.
And the fiscal statement states that this is in the governor's budget, and it also does not come from the general fund, and there is no recommendation to go to Ways and Means.
All right, and so the record states that we do not have a requirement to refer this to Ways and Means based on it being within the budget of the governor. Is that correct?
Yes, and that it's not coming from the general.
Correct. Okay.
Do you have any? I don't have anything of any written testimony at all this hearing from this bill. Maybe I wasn't here. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to catch up on this.
Senator Beyer, that's quite all right. I've made some notes on my original SMS without attributing who they're to, so that I did get some of the testimony.
Has this bill been through MWAC also?
Yes.
It has been.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to Bill 119.
Senator Beyer moves the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 119. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 119 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Glad I don't have to carry it.
We got that covered for you, I assure you. Senator Beyer moves the bill as amended, Senate Bill 119 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So be it. And so ordered. And we will have Senator Ringo carry this one. I love this. Now, if he's listening, maybe he'll run back down here. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 119, and at this time we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 37.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 37 allows the Employment Department to assess unpaid unemployment insurance tax debts against a successful employer if the enterprise is substantially the same as the entity that acquired the debt, and it allows for an appeal. We do have a dash one amendment that requires the employment director to adopt rules for the purposes of determining a successor employer, clarifying that an interest of a passive investor is not a person with a direct or indirect interest. We heard this bill on February 1st. It has an indeterminate fiscal impact. It has a revenue impact statement that's been issued.
And it's my understanding, Senator Beyer, I think this is one that you actually worked with the employment department and getting the dash ones done, if I remember.
Mr. Chair, I do remember this bill, yes. We when this bill was brought forward, I asked the employment department to look into the statutes because the construction contractor board has a similar statute on their issue of dealing with successor businesses. That was done. The dash one amendments, we may want to ask them to clarify that because I didn't draft them, but they are supposed to reflect the similar language from the Construction Contractors Board that has worked very well in that industry to try to stop fraudulent operators from leaving one LLC and forming another one or partnership and to avoid taxes. So I think that's what it is.
We have a volunteer at the dais.
Senator Brzezinski and Senator Beyer. I'm Renee Bryant. I'm the tax action manager for the Employment Department. Senator Beyer just explained it very correctly. What we don't want to do is to pass on this liability to those individuals who have a incidental de minimis investment in a business, and these amendments will take care of that.
Okay. Senator Beyer.
I just say thank you, and move the dash one amendments in Senate Bill 37.
Senator Byers moved the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 37. Is there any other discussion? Any objection? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 37 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves Senate Bill 37 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Beyer, I'll be glad to carry this unless you want to carry it.
I did fine. I can carry it.
Okay. Senator Beyer will be our carrier. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 37. And at this time, I'd like to go ahead and I think this takes care of everything except for two bills that we had for public hearing, Senate Bill 334 and 339. And what I'm going to do is ask Karen if you could bring us both sheets because my understanding they may be somewhat related, and we may open up a dual hearing on those.
Thank you.
Yeah, and let me. I think what I'm going to go ahead and do, Council, why don't you go ahead and give us the intro on both of these bills. I believe the sponsor of the bills may want to collapse these into 334 and not move 339, but I'm going to open them up and we'll take testimony on both of them now, and then we'll figure out where we go from there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 334 requires conditions for physicians performing physical examinations under personal injury protection benefits and motor vehicle liability policies. And Senate Bill 339 establishes an independent medical examination program in the Department of Consumer and Business Services, requires defendant requesting a physical exam arising out of a motor vehicle claim to choose a physician assigned by the independent medical examination program. Senate Bill 339 needs a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
339 does?
Yep.
All right. With that understood, I've got Mr. Jackson, you're here to give testimony, it looks like, on 334. I don't have you listed for 339, but please come on up, and let's just make sure that if you'll just tell us which one you're going to be. If it's limited just to 334, so be it. Okay, and before you start, Mr. Jackson, we do have in our possession two letters that were delivered to us, one for 334 and one for 339 from Safeco. And we will have those, and they are part of the written record.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, members of the committee, I will not be testifying on 339, the Oregon Trial. I'm Neil Jackson with the Oregon Trial Lawyers. I won't be testifying on 339. Our legislative committee has decided we are not in favor of that bill. I don't speak for the Oregon State Bar, but I happen to know the Oregon State Bar is also against that bill. I've had communications with the bar. I'm here to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 334. The bills really are different. They're not the same thing. Senate Bill 334 deals with the situation of automobile accident. The insured, not at fault insured, needs medical treatment, they're injured, and they go to see their doctor. And after what's happened over the years is a cottage industry has developed where these independent medical examination companies have hired doctors to agree to perform physical examinations for purposes of determining whether the party was injured. And basically what has happened is that your carrier, your insurance company, through your personal injury protection coverage, pays for your own medical bills that are incurred as a result of the injuries you've sustained in an accident. Over the years, it has developed that these companies have advertised to the insurance industry, hey, we have doctors that will perform these personal injury protection IMEs and will determine whether the person was really injured, whether the treatment they're receiving is reasonable and necessary, how long they should be treated, is it a permanent injury, etc.
Mr. Jackson, I'm going to ask you to stop just for a second. Yeah. Mr. Powell, you and Mr. Sim, I guess, are the two that are listed in opposition to Senate Bill 339. Since I have no one here as proponents to 339, would you have any objection for me closing the public hearing on 339? So we're going to go ahead and just for the record, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 339, keeping open the public hearing on Senate Bill 334. Sorry, Mr. Jackson, please continue.
That's fine. What happens is you're getting your treatment, your carrier is paying for the bills, they send a letter to you and say, I want you to go see our doctor, I want to have you examined to see if the treatment you're receiving is appropriate, see how you're doing. You then go to see the doctor that they've decided you're going to go see. That doctor does an examination, and uniformly, I've practiced for 27 years, I've seen about three cases where in this independent examination, the doctor said, yes, the treatment is appropriate, they need more treatment. What's really happening is they're being examined. These so-called independent examiners are saying, you're going to be better in another 3 weeks, and then cut off treatment. I had one situation where this young lady, a really bad accident. She got T-boned. She was in a van, hit the driver's side. She was driving. She was literally home bedbound. She didn't receive any broken bones, but the hit was so hard she was in her bed for a month. After she started having physical therapy, saw an MD. After 4 months, she got an IME letter from her carrier. They sent her to this doctor who did an examination. In his report, he spent 6 pages talking about how badly she was injured in this accident. On the last page, the question was, does she need more treatment? His answer was, she needs to go swimming. What he said was she needs two lessons in pool therapy and cut off all the other treatment. I was outraged. So was my client. Today I got a call on another case where this young lady got a very serious injury. No broken bones again, but she took a really hard hit. It totaled her van. She had the accident on January 4th. Today is March 24th. They are sending her to an IME. I know the doctor they're sending her to. I've seen 25 reports from this doctor. I know what the doctor is going to say. He's going to say it's been when she's completed 3 months of treatment, she doesn't need any more treatment. What this bill does is establishes some protections, which we already have. This is only with your own insurance company. If you get in litigation, our rules and our statutes allow the defendant, the defense, to ask the court to order an independent medical exam. In those situations, under our present rules, you have to go, but you are allowed to, in Multnomah County, in all cases, you are allowed to audiotape that examination. And that's very important because then you have a record of what actually went on in that room with that, quote, independent doctor. In Multnomah County, you're also allowed to obtain information concerning how much money that doctor earns conducting independent medical examinations. And the courts are saying, we're going to go back 3 years and we're going to find out how much money the doctor makes doing these IMEs. Those are protections that if you have to go to trial allow you to question the doctor's bias if the doctor is doing an inordinate number of these things. Because understand, these doctors are not examining the patient to treat them. They're examining the patient for the insurance company to determine whether or not the person was really injured or how bad the injuries were. Senate Bill 334 allows not only audio tape but videotape of these PIP examinations. This is your own insurance company sent you to this doctor. It also allows the same types of protections as far as obtaining, and I will be honest with you, 334 makes a broader requirement of the physicians that conduct the IME. It would require the physician to provide 3 years prior of redacted IME reports on other people that they've done. One of the things that's happening is the doctors that conduct these examinations, they have a computer program. If you start reading a bunch of their reports, you will see they all read the same. They all say the same thing. They'll change the name, they'll change the age, but these are canned reports that they are generating. And the whole purpose of these examinations, I'm telling you, is to cut off the treatment by your own carrier of the medical treatment that you're receiving because they want to minimize their costs. I understand why they want to minimize their costs, but I suggest to you it's being abused at this point. This is your own company that is sending you to a doctor who is going to cut your treatment off. This bill provides some protections, which we already get in a litigation setting, but in the PIP setting, none of these protections are available. I talked to a friend of mine this morning. He told me that he had gone with no mention at all by the insurance company that his client could not take a videotape. He had gone to the PIP IME with a videotape machine. Initially, he was told that they would go ahead with the IME. But then the doctor who was going to conduct it called the company he was conducting it for, came back and said, no, you're not going to videotape this. They wouldn't let him do it, and so it didn't happen. His own insurance carrier then cut off payment and said, you refused to cooperate. You refused to do the PIP IME under our conditions. We told you you couldn't videotape. You went ahead and said you were going to. We're not going to pay any more medical bills. That's not an unusual situation. 334 tries to establish them for protections for your constituents, the consumers, so that they can get the treatment they need, or if they, because they're still going to have to go to these things. But if they have to go, it provides some protections to make sure that they've got some rights too that will protect their rights. So I'd urge your support.
Mr. Jackson, thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Mr. Jackson? Senator Wissett.
Chair Brzezinski, Mr. Jackson. Are these egregious cases reported to the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners?
There is no violation of the ethical rules because medicine is an art, not a science. That's what we're told. And one expert's opinion concerning the extent of injuries that a person may have sustained, because it disagrees with the treating physician, it doesn't constitute an ethical violation.
Okay.
Mr. Jackson, do you know, we've heard testimony before that in some cases, or maybe in all cases where you're dealing with an IME, that there has been a position taken, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I don't know if anyone's here from the OMA, but my understanding, there's not, has been established a patient-doctor relationship.
That's correct.
And because of that, that has not been an issue that they follow up on.
Right. They, aside from the fact that there is no ethical violation on a disagreement, the person examining is not examining to treat, therefore the person he's examining is not his patient, and therefore the prescriptions under the medical ethics rules do not apply.
I would disagree with that. If you actually, if you examine someone and make a diagnosis, which that requires, then you have practiced medicine, you have established a patient relationship, at least if you're treating animals, you have. However, I talked with someone with the Board of Medical Examiners today, and that may be their position. I haven't got
It might be worth us, I'll ask counsel to make a note of that and see if we can't get someone from the Board of Medical Examiners to come forward, or at least we'll make the inquiry and see what there is, and possibly if we have additional testimony on this, we may be able to get them down here.
I would very much like to ask them a few questions, because what we're being told here, you know, certainly if there is a pattern misdiagnosing a problem repeatedly with their different clients, it would seem that the Board of Medical Examiners would be interested in it. And if they're not interested in it, then either they're not doing their job, or they really don't think there's misdiagnosis going on. But I think it would be very worthwhile to have that discussion.
All right. Thank you, Senator Witsit.
Chairman Przanski and Senator Witsit, every PIP IME report that is generated specifically says in the report no doctor-patient relationship was established. It specifically says it in every one of the reports. It's in there. They put it in every time. So,
Mr. Jackson, we appreciate it. I think we understand the issue. We're going to see if we can't get something from the Board of Medical Examiners. And let me just see. I think Senator Beyer had another question, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this is your bill or your requested bill, but I'm just curious how subsection 1 or section 2, how you would propose that you can make this work, that the examiners, the physicians have to have less than 50% of their gross annual income from conducting examinations requested of a third party.
In Chairman Przanski, Senator Byers, in the context of litigation, the court has ruled that they will accept an affidavit from the physician as to the percentage of income that they gain from IME examinations versus treating patients. I'm not saying that that's what I suspect. That the court would accept the same kind of affidavit from the physician. This is not a fishing expedition about the doctors. You know, we're not asking for tax returns or anything. The court has ruled that they will accept an affidavit where the physician says, I make this much off IMEs.
Anything else? Mr. Jackson, thank you very much. If you'll step back, I'll ask for our next panel to come forward. John Powell. Steve Morrell, I believe, and Bill Sim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. And in the interest of time, Mr. Chair, and the fact that we still have some physical exams to do tonight, I'll turn it over to Mr. Syme, who is an attorney here in Salem and is a litigator and probably would say nearly the same things we would, and we would follow up then if there's anything that we think should be added.
Mr. Syme, I apologize on your pronunciation of your name. Please give us your testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bill Syme, and I am a member of the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel. I am an attorney here in private practice in Salem. I've been practicing for over 22 years, and my practice personally consists primarily of defense of civil litigation, and certainly that's the purpose of our organization. And we're here basically on a fairness issue with these bills, and particularly Senate Bill 334. This is a bill that I think is not necessary. It is would establish bad public policy. It, most importantly, it places an unnecessary and unfair restriction on the integrity of the independent medical examination process and on an insurer or a litigant's right to select their own retained experts on a particular case. And that's significant. And this bill should not pass out of this committee. Now, the primary purpose of this bill seems to be directed towards the personal injury protection context. And there are going to be many times where there is a legitimate and good faith dispute concerning the nature of an injury that has been sustained by a car accident or whether the continuing treatment is reasonable or necessary. And those disputes generally are going to either be resolved by agreement of the parties, or if they can't agree, then that's going to be decided by arbitration or trial. Sometimes what's going to happen is an insurance company gets a barrage of medical records within the first 60 days, and you could have, for example, $5,000 or $6,000 worth of chiropractic treatment in that first 60 days, and the company's going to look at that and say, what have we faced here? The claims representative is not a medically trained person. They're going to need to defer to someone else to get a fair idea about what's going on with the case, and so that's why the independent medical examination process gets involved before litigation. There are times that a claims decision has already been made and a lawsuit is filed, or it's in arbitration concerning that, and a request for an independent medical examination is made after that while the matter is in litigation or in arbitration. Now, there are a number of cases, and I cited to you in a paper that's called Independent Medical Examinations, the Selection and Qualifications of the Examiner. And this is an excerpt from a presentation I made to the Oregon Law Institute, or a program sponsored by that. There have been many situations where the plaintiff or the injured party challenges the qualifications of the doctor who's been selected to do the independent medical examination on the basis that the doctor does a vast majority of their practice only doing the independent medical examinations, or they're hired by the insurance company, or their vast majority of their income is derived from the independent medical examinations, or they routinely find that a person's not injured. These have all been objections that have gone through the court system and have been litigated, and without exception, the courts have said that an insurer or a defendant has the right to select their own doctor that they're going to have conduct this independent medical examination. And if there are questions about bias, then that's something that can be pointed out either in the arbitration hearing or trial by cross-examination, or the plaintiff or the injured party can present their own plaintiff treating physician who has their own bias. But these are things that if there is a dispute based on the fact that the person has is a part of an IME panel, that's something that's going to be decided in the crucible of a trial by the trier of fact, by the claimant or the injured party bringing out that bias if there's an alleged bias. But it's not a basis to say you can't use this particular doctor on this particular exam. And there's many reasons why people select IME doctors. You get, as a person defending a case, select an IME doctor based on their education, training, and experience, their board certifications, their availability to do the examination or to appear at trial, and, candidly, their qualities as a witness at trial. And this bill would significantly interfere with an insurance company's right to select who they want to conduct that examination. And it does so, I submit to you, in an arbitrary fashion. This first subsection 1 says that the person would essentially be disqualified from conducting any examination if 50% or more of their income is derived from conducting these IMEs. And I submit to you that is an arbitrary and unfair conclusive presumption about the competency of the witness. And what it says is basically a presumption that if 50% or more of your income is derived from IME, you are biased and prejudiced and incompetent to conduct the examination. But if only 49% of your income is, then you can go ahead and do the exam. I don't think there's any rational basis to that. I submit to you that there is no substantial need for this bill, and that has not been demonstrated. There was a question question about the physician-patient privilege and whether this is something, the IME process, that can be regulated by the Board of Medical Examiners. And I submit to you that there is no physician-patient privilege established from the independent medical examination process or the fact you conduct the examination, but that doesn't mean that the doctor who conducts the examination is not subject to scrutiny by the Board of Medical Examiners or that they're not subject to the ethical guidelines by the Board of Medical Examiners. I submit to you the opposite is true. It's just like a lawyer. I may not have a attorney-client relationship with a particular person, but I'm still bound by the lawyer's ethical duties and obligations and bound by the Board Bar Governors and the State Bar disciplinary rules in the conduct of my affairs in litigation.
Mr. Syme, I guess as an attorney, I would just want to question that because my understanding is that if someone seeks out legal advice from me, whether they're paying me or not, there is an attorney-client privilege as compared to what I've heard from the Board of Medical Examiners. Do you take the position that us as attorneys, we don't have that? If someone actually seeks out some type of legal advice to us, doesn't that actually attach us to the attorney-client privilege? And that there is, in fact, a relationship that's created by that, even if we aren't getting paid?
My point was, even though I don't have an attorney-client relationship with someone, I'm still bound by a lawyer's ethical duties and obligations. So, for example, if I make a misrepresentation to the court about something, I don't have a legal relationship with that court as a client, but I'm still bound by the ethical rules.
Okay.
That was my only point. And I think really why you see that no physician-patient relationship language in the IME context is that the doctors don't want to establish a continuing duty to advise or treat or diagnose the patient. So that's why I think that that's included. The issue about the videotape or audio tape of the examination, as it stands now, the way that an IME is conducted is done by agreement of the parties. If there is no agreement, then that's something that can be resolved by a court, setting the terms and conditions of the independent medical examination. There should not be any sort of automatic default provision that says that you're going to videotape or audio tape an exam. Some doctors don't mind that at all, having the audio tape. Some do. This is something that was considered by the Council on Court Procedures last year. They did an extensive study on the project. There was a proposal to amend the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure number 44 to require either videotaping or audiotaping of these exams, and that was a proposal that was defeated and was not passed through the Council on Court Procedures. As far as the videotaping is concerned and the audiotaping concerned, the physical examinations is one thing. There is a real concern for the psychological examination or the neuropsychological examination and having those videotaped or audiotaped. That is an external interference with that exam, and most psychiatrists or psychologists would tell you that it can have effect of influence the exam and how that's conducted, and there's a real concern about the integrity of the exam process and the testing process. The last provision here would require, it basically is a discovery rule and would require compelled discovery of IME doctors' reports over the last 3 years, and that's not a good idea at all. I've got a number of concerns. One is that this is, I don't think any compelling need has been established for that. It's a discovery rule that's not reciprocal in nature. And candidly, there are doctors and chiropractors out there who are known to be patient advocates and are selected as the treating physician either by a patient or their lawyer because they are known to be patient advocates and are effective witnesses. And that's a concern. That this is not reciprocal in nature, if you could have that sort of discovery. And I have seen computer-generated chiropractor reports that are same from patient to patient on the plaintiff's side. And that's something that if you're going to allow that sort of discovery for the defendant's IME, you should allow that sort of discovery for the plaintiff's treating physician with names redacted. And I don't think the OTLA is advocating that position at all. But if you this is unfair to have a unilateral discovery only one way. And I guess the last concern I have, and it's stated in my written materials, is that this is something that is, at least as far as the reports themselves, would say that these are something that may be admitted. And I'm concerned that would require a court then to say these must be admitted if there's a contested case hearing in an arbitration or a jury trial. And it is the trial judge who is in the best position to make determinations of relevancy or whether a particular document, if relevant, should nevertheless be excluded for other reasons such as confusion of issues or something that would be misleading to the jury. I would rely upon my other written materials I've submitted to you, and would be happy to answer any questions of the committee, that concludes my remarks.
Thank you. Mr. Powell, Jimmy. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, at State Farm last year requested IMEs on 2%, roughly 2% of those who claim FIP benefits. And each exam costs, on average, $700, a little bit more. It's not something that's done lightly. It's not something that's done in every case. And it's something that's done when, in fact, there's the need for some collaboration with the medical community to understand exactly what the status of this particular claim it is. So it's done very rarely. We think the bill, clearly, if you look at it just on its surface, increases the costs very substantially of this. It's an automatic discovery tool. It's almost a trial preparation. You've got film running. You've got 3 years of records with redacted names in it, which is laborious and expensive. And so it's apparently designed just to shut down the IME process. We think that if there is a problem with a carrier abusing this system, that there are regulations and there could be audits done by the insurance division. So we think there is some regulatory scope that could be applied to this if there people are in fact abusing the system. Thank you, Mr. Powell. Is it Mr.
Merle. I'm Steve Merle, Chair Przanski. I'm a claim attorney for State Farm. I agree with everything that both Mr. Sine and Mr. Powell said. I would like to only add that I'd like the committee to understand that when an IME is requested, it's a decision that is made with some consideration. It takes management involvement at State Farm. A representative on their own is not allowed to do it, and to a certain extent, you have to kind of pass a this is really shocking me sort of test, or else we're not understanding what's going on with this person medically for us to request an IME. I get somewhat concerned when I hear some of the comments about insurance companies that we're somehow trying to minimize cost. I'm a mutual company. I'm owned by my policyholders. I have an obligation to pay them what's owed, and that's what we want to do. That's also part of what the IME process does for us, is it lets us know whether we owe this person so I can treat that person fairly as well as the greater body of policyholders who own our company. The last thing is that one of the consequences, I think, of the bill will be to shrink the pool of qualified people to do IMEs because a lot of people are not going to want to put up with the hassle. I don't think that is a good result for either consumers or for the industry, either one.
Thank you. Any questions? That was like one question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Przanski. I'm shocked that you don't like my bill. You're right. The vast majority of people who go to a physician after they've been in an accident do so for one purpose, and that's to get better. They need treatment. Mr. Sine, you mentioned something about chiropractor records. Let's take chiropractors and put them in another category, because I'm not. But let's talk about people who go to a medical doctor and they follow up with physical therapy because they've genuinely been hurt and they have one concern, and that's to get better. That's far different than than an insurance company that sends somebody to an independent medical examiner, because too often that person is an advocate. That doctor, and I understand in a perfect world they really would be giving an independent evaluation, but the reality is oftentimes they're an advocate, and that doctor knows that. And there's so many examples where those doctors, they give a very cursory examination. They spend 5 minutes with that patient, and then they come out with this long report that has little bearing with the examination, and it's clearly tailored to defeat that person's claim. I mean, that I just admit for me, won't you, that has happened. There are doctors out there like that IME doctors that are not interested in an independent exam, that they're there for an advocacy purpose.
Senator Przanski and Senator Ringo, in defending a case, it does me no good to ask for an independent medical examination from a doctor that I know has some bias. I want to have an opinion that I can rely upon, whether it's good or bad, whether it hurts my case or helps my case. I need to have an opinion that I can count on, something that's good to withstand scrutiny in front of a jury if the case has to go that far. And if there is a problem with the medical examination, such as it only lasted 5 minutes, or what is recorded in the report for the medical history is not accurate, or there's a disagreement as to the conclusion it stated in the report, then that's something you can bet will be brought out in cross-examination by the claimant or their attorney.
Mr. Chair? But I mean, that assumes that it goes that far. You know, a lot of times there's not even an attorney involved, or if there is, that, you know, it's not going to get to court, and that you've had an exam that really is advocacy, and it's just not a fair exam. And, you know, what's contained in this bill, one of the bills, I think it's 334, is just intended to put some sideboards on it. And you know, I guess I'd just appreciate a suggestion on how it can be made more fair, because there's so much evidence that it is a problem. It's a problem getting impartial, independent exams. How do we do that?
Senator Przanski and Senator Ringo, I don't see that what is proposed in Senate Bill 334 gets to your end, particularly the thing that says that if more than 50% or more of an income is derived from doing independent medical examinations, that doctor is per se then disqualified from doing exams. I don't think it gets there.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Last person I have on the list is Hysena Squires. And as she's coming up, is there anyone else that's here that wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 334? Hysena?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hysena Squires on behalf of the Independent Medical Examination Association. I would just like to echo the comments of the previous witnesses and maybe just provide a little bit of information. I represent the facilities that actually facilitate independent medical exams. I just heard your comment, Senator Ringo, regarding the five-minute exam, and so I just did a quick survey in the back of the room. My clients indicate to me that most of their doctors spend at least 30 to 45 minutes in the room with the patient, not just reviewing the chart. So that's...
I wish that was the standard.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, it appears to be so for my clients, so I'm proud of that then. I guess, Senator Ringo, I understand your concern about believing that there is a problem and wanting to have some sort of solution and put some sideboards up regarding the PIP process. I would just remind the committee that Senate Bill 311, which relates to independent medical examinations with respect to workers' compensation, has quite a few amendments and has been a lengthy, long, drawn-out process that we believe will result ultimately when the amendments are adopted and the bills move through the process. Maybe something that you may want to take a look at as far as a model for PIP issues also. So with that, I'd just like to express our opposition to the bill as it's currently written and provide any resource material that we can for you from our association and with respect to PIP reports that you'd like to see with redacted information and maybe perhaps walk you through the process of how our facilities go about conducting those examinations.
Any questions? Thank you very much. If there's no one else here to testify on Senate Bill
334. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 334. And Council, I believe, looking at my agenda, that takes care of the bills that were before us today. Is there anything else that we need to cover?
No, I think we covered it all.
All right, before adjourning to the remaining members here, thank you very much for staying here, hearing us out, and getting everything through. And we'll go ahead and adjourn. I hope everyone has a safe Friday, and we'll see everyone on Tuesday, if not before. Senate Commerce is adjourned for the day.